And there's a bus going by. How about that? It's Riding Misterioso, and for the traditionalists among you, here's this.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Misterioso.
I was just dealing with extremely loud sirens going by. A few of the listeners, when I said I was thinking about switching over to doing this from home, and said, "Oh, but it won't be the show without those horrible sirens in the background." But that's the way things go because we have to evolve, and I don't want people irritated by coming to the show and hearing things like, "Can you hear me? Is the guest still there? Are they there?" Which you might hear during this show. I'm sorry to say, because of things that are kind of out of my control. So I'm trying to put it all back in my control. Our guest today, as promised, last week and this week. Last week, through uncontrollable circumstances, he could not appear. This week, he can appear. Peter Robbins has been on with me before. He's a good friend. Peter, I don't even know how to introduce you, except for the fact that everybody should know that you co-wrote Left at Eastgate, right?
Oh, that's true, and that's as good an introduction as I need.
Yeah, and he's a great storyteller, a great writer, and I've had him on in both capacities on this show. And he also has interests in other stuff, which we'll get into. Peter, a couple people asked about some of your other interests, which we've mentioned on this show, and which I think you've mentioned on interviews. I mean, Peter, you know, I think you're probably on an interview every couple of days now because everybody has a podcast. Is that not true?
It's amazing in the world of broadcasting that my voice does reverberate through the universe occasionally.
And let's see. I think this is your third time, at least, on the show where I have been recording it, and I'll be able to put it up on the Radio Misterioso site.
Very good.
The reason I wanted to have you on, and this was like a couple of months ago, and I talked to you about this at the time, was this sort of new, at least to some people, wrinkle in the Rendlesham story, which we will get to. And I don't know if we should background people in it. Do you have like a do you have a 1 minute, you know what, a 1 minute recap of the story for people who've been living in caves and do not know about the Rendlesham incident of December 1980.
In December 1980, on three consecutive nights between Christmas and New Year's, a series of UFO sightings, events, landings, incursions, appearances occurred in and around a twin base NATO complex, RAF Bentwaters, where most of the men involved were stationed, and their sister base, RAF Woodbridge, a scant 6 miles away or so. The events ranged from unknowns firing beams of light that we would now consider, I guess, like industrial lasers, but back in 1980, it would have been highly unusual to start with, down into the weapons storage area to actual landings in the forest, tearing out parts of forest canopy, tearing bark off of trees, leaving impressions with background beta and gamma radiation readings in them in the ground, and ultimately the appearance of a machine of undetermined origin that was witnessed by a number of men, and including my co-author, Larry Warren, who at the time of these events was a United States Air Force security police officer. The events were hushed up, to put it mildly. The men were debriefed with quite a remarkable event in itself, which I'm as sure as I can be that was disinformation, namely a mixture of truth and fiction and confabulation to produce a certain result. And men were taken against their will, were put through the ringer mentally. False impressions were created in their minds, and ultimately, due to Larry's going forward, breaking security, going on the record with all that he remembered, a Freedom of Information Act in 1983 resulted in the release of what for many years was the only document that was out there regarding this event, the so-called HALT document, named after the deputy base commander who wrote it. And since October of 1983, this case has been in the public realm, so to say.
Right. And a lot of people don't know that you wrote the book. When was it released? 97?
Yes, it first came out in 1997. I'm still very proud of the fact that it went on to become a very serious bestseller in the United Kingdom at that time. And it was republished in 2005 on the event's 25th anniversary by Cosimo Press in New York in an expanded and updated edition.
You know what I noticed when I went to – can you hear me okay?
Yep.
What I noticed when I went to the Wikipedia article, I don't think you're mentioned once.
Yeah, how about that?
What happened?
Well, remember, Wikipedia can be rewritten by anyone that wants to.
There's right,
a fair
right.
amount of resentment, animosity, something less than goodwill toward our making these events as public as we did in 1997, and the controversy still rages.
Right. They, I was surprised when I'm reading it. It's like, okay, yeah, I guess I've heard all that. Because, Peter, I read the book probably a year or two after it came out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I read the entire thing. And
that's a lot of reading.
Yeah,
it's
and
a
I read,
big honking book.
Yeah, and there's a lot of information in there. And none of it made it onto the Wikipedia site, which obvious stuff that everybody knows about the case, but... not anything else. Kind of like every year they have the Roswell. Are you still running the Roswell or involved with the public relations on the Roswell Festival?
I lost my job working for the city of Roswell, a job I enjoyed very much.
Yeah.
About a year and a half ago, when the mayorship changed hands. The new mayor, who I wish well, decided to go with somebody more local to oversee, to take over my job. I guess it's sort of an offhanded compliment that fell apart earlier this year, and they are rushing to fill the void with some kind of event this July. But it is not happening officially right now, and that's a shame.
Yeah. The reason I brought it up is because every time I've been to Roswell, I never hear Bill Moore's name mentioned. Or, you know, Stanton Friedman, because he's there all the time.
And yes, he's pretty much of a regular. The museum there brings him in annually to discuss new aspects of research. And, of course, it was Stan that was the one who found Jesse Marcel and
right.
did the first interview with him. Bless his heart. I'm so glad... Major Marcel had a chance to go on record before passing.
Yeah.
What this did to his life was absolutely horrible.
Yeah. And I never mentioned it in any one of my talks. I always wanted to say, you know, this wouldn't be happening here unless that book had been written.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Well, it was the first, and that came out in 1980, the same year as the Rendlesham Forest incident.
Yes, that's right.
Truth
yeah.
Or coincidence.
I don't know if it's a coincidence. I don't know. Who knows? I hope it is. Isn't? I don't know. You know, the other strange coincidence that one of the listeners brought up,
yeah,
and I hadn't thought about it for years, was it happened within like a day or of the Cash Landrum incident.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And that, for folks that are not familiar with that, that's another seminally important UFO incident dating also from late December 1980, where two Texas women and the grandson of one of them observed a machine of undetermined origin. But in that case, as best I recall, it was accompanied by quite a retinue of very terrestrial helicopters.
Right.
I think that is – people have asked me over the years if I felt that because of that very pronounced timing that there's a connection between the two events. And I don't think so. I don't believe so. Nothing I've ever seen has led me to feel that.
Yeah, that was actually one of the questions from one of the listeners. I was like, is there any kind of – I don't see how there could be any connection. Although for that case, and I don't know if this is how you feel, I heavily lean towards, you know, atomic-powered craft and not any kind of strange explanation because of the, you know, mere fact of just the helicopters all are herding it around.
Yeah, I guess in retrospect I have to agree with you at least to some degree. Because, number one, there's no question in any of our minds, believers, debunkers, skeptics like us who try to approach this with a reasoned eye, that we human beings have things up there that are so advanced that they might as well be, you know, craft from parts unknown.
Yeah.
And the rather tragic and chilling fact that I think it was – I'm trying to remember whether it was Cash or Landrum who developed a terrible cancer, which I don't think was a very common one immediately following the event, and possibly the grandson as well.
Right.
It does sound like that they were exposed, or at least there's a possibility that they were exposed to some kind of unshielded, you know, radioactive source. Again, this is all food for speculation.
Yeah, and you can take – we will get back to the Rendlesham incident in momentarily. You can take – and this is just Peter and I talking shop, I think. Mm. You can take it for – and I think you – I don't know if you've heard this or not, but and of all people – I heard this from Rick Doty, so take that for what you want.
Mm-hmm.
But I asked him about Cash Landrum in the midst of talking about some other stuff, and he said, well, what that was a nuclear-powered craft that had gone awry and was having problems. And I said, well, what kind of problems? And he went and described the craft to me. He said it was 1970s technology. The reason there were no windows in it is because this thing was so heavily shielded, so the pilots wouldn't get irradiated, which is kind of weird. Why would they have the thing out there shooting radiation? Maybe it's not supposed to. I mean, it might have developed a leak or something. But
it also is somewhat questionable in that how is it that one of these women, you know, developed a cancer from this? The other one didn't. I don't know. And, you know, Doty himself, who is, of course, a former special agent for the FBI, if I remember correctly.
AFOSI.
Oh, right. AFOSI, Air Force Office of Special Investigation, according to whom you speak to, may or may not be somebody who is a source of disinformation.
That's why I said you have to take it with it for what you want.
Not to belabor the point, but sometimes people hear that word and don't realize that we're not talking about lies necessarily, but a often very skillful mixture
yes.
of truth, fiction, confabulation to produce any number of specific results.
Yeah. He said that the cameras, and they had cameras all around it so they could see where they were going since there were no windows, and the cameras had cut out, or some of them had, so they were kind of dead in the water, or they couldn't really see where they were going. And that was the answer to why there was a problem. Like I said, I don't know. You take that with a grain of salt. But the main thing, the reason I mention it, Peter, and it goes out on the, you know, on the podcast, is that maybe at some point somebody will hear that and be able to confirm or deny that a little bit better than I have been able to.
Yeah, very good point.
So back to the Rendlesham case. Did you hear recently, and I'm sure you did, the theory about and I guess this had been kicking around for quite a while, that it was that the events of those nights in December of 1980 were the result of some sort of security experiment or exercise mixed with some sort of psychological experiment or exercise?
Absolutely. This, as you say, has been one of the theories put forward from the time the events first had a public perspective. And even after 9 years of intensive investigation and the publication of a major book on it, you know, the book kind of opens and closes as something of a legal brief. And I do tend to irritate certain people who figure if you spend that much time investigating one event, then words like expert, which for me is a really uncomfortable word when you're dealing with the unknown, or authority, or that you should be the one who knows the answers. After all of these years, I can ask better questions than most people, maybe more educated questions, but I'm damned if I know the answers. And I didn't enter into this with an agenda or with a pet theory. I just, you know, rode the horse in the direction it was going and followed every lead that Larry and I were able to dig up over the years. So, you know, if something that is interpreted as the kind of proof that would win a major court case is ever put forward, I'm not going to lose a night's sleep about it. However, there are physical evidences that we've established beyond any reasonable doubt that something truly anomalous did happen. However, that understood, some months back, a very extensive official or official seeming document was sent to a researcher in England, not the best known, a woman who lives up in northern England, named Sasha Christie, who I know in passing, nice person, tough gal, you know, very in your face about wanting to find out more about this.
Yeah.
And that in itself was fascinating to me. She's not a major player. She's just out there and, you know, very outspoken about her views on this incident. But this 250-page plus United States government document is emailed to her, and she makes it available, you know, on the internet. It goes viral. Yeah. And yes, it does put forward that the events were some kind of psyops operation. And that is one of the allegations that's floating around out there. I'm looking forward to seeing Sasha next month in England and discussing this with her in a more detailed manner. I have not read the full 250 pages yet. I've been going over it as time allows. I'm impressed and I'm not impressed. And again, if I personally, along with my co-author, had not actually come upon, discovered, had laboratory analysis done on organic material that had been in contact with the machine of undetermined origin that Larry was involved in witnessing in the end of the events in late December 1980, then I might be leaning more heavily toward this. But again, it might well have been part of what transpired there in Suffolk, England, back at the end of 1980.
Yeah, you know, Peter, I read through as much of that document as I could, and then I just started reading what she had highlighted, because she went through and helpfully highlighted stuff that she thought was relevant to the Rendlesham incident. And like you, I was kind of at pains to try and figure out how that had a direct relationship causally with anything that was going on at the time. It looks, you know, it looks like there's a strong indication that a lot of the stuff that went on there, a lot of things that were witnessed, could have been produced by the technology at the time. I'm not sure all of it, but yeah. But to me, it's the question is still up in the air. I don't categorically deny anything that she's come up with, and I'm no expert by any means. But it hasn't convinced me yet. I also noticed that she's one of the speakers at the Rendlesham conference.
She is indeed. Sasha has had lifelong experiences, abduction-related experiences, like many people have, and is very public about them.
Yeah.
And to the best of my understanding, that will be what her talk is about. I'm hoping right now it's looking like the program, as many good conference programs do have, will end with all of us presenters up on stage together, taking any and all questions that audience members want to throw at us. Mm-hmm. And there's just going to be an ongoing dialogue throughout this rather extraordinary one-day event. So it will be, I'm sure, a really open exchange of ideas, some good debates, arguments, questioning of what's been put forward. Over this past year, in a way, the credibility of the events, which for me constitute a tremendously important incident, as important as anything that I'm aware of in the history of UFO studies, I guess you'd have to call me biased, having committed myself to studying it for such a prolonged period of time, to the exclusion of a lot of other stuff. But I pride myself on my objectivity, and, you know, I'm not married to this in some weird way or something. But the whole putting forward that two of the witnesses have done, Jim Peniston and John Burroughs, that they, without any doubt, the events were caused by time travelers from our future. I'm not closed-minded to the idea, although I'm not a person who feels that time travel is possible, at least to the best of my tiny little ability to wrap my head around it. And John and Jim have said they're working on a book about it now, and anybody that's interested in the case should hold judgment until we see it. However, this has become such a cause celeb and so spun out of control on a certain level that, you know, there are people now who are coming to hear about this incident as, oh, there are some people that were involved that say it was time travelers. Other people say it was a psyops operation. Sounds like a bunch of silly stuff to me. What's on TV?
Yeah.
In a sense, the disinformation, intentional or not, is already in play here. And
right.
After 31 years, and we're coming into the 31 and a half anniversary, so to say, the forces that be have a great deal invested, I've come to be convinced of, in making this thing look silly. And you may remember that on the 50th anniversary of Roswell, debate it, you know, forever as we may want to, the Air Force came out with one of the most pompous pieces of nonsense that any government agency has ever put out relative to trying to make the whole UFO phenomenon look silly, which is a book that was about as big as the New York City phone book.
Oh, it was huge,
Called Roswell Case Closed, and talking about the crash dummies. Of course, they didn't appear until 1952, and the event was in 47, and more about the Mogul weather balloon, and all of this total patent nonsense, which, again, may well be an offhand compliment that they want to kill these stories, the really important ones. There is a great deal invested in making them look silly, and they're not time-sensitive. If you can hit them with something that makes them seem more nonsensical, 30, 50 years after the fact, go for it. And that concerns me. That concerns me, and I'm hoping to address some of that in my presentation next month at this terrific conference that I'll be speaking at in England.
Yeah. It seems like it's but you know what do you think is the motivation behind that? My personally, I think it's just because, look, it's something we've swept under the table because we don't understand it and we don't really want to deal with it right now. So let's just not really get people asking questions, no matter what the thing turns out to be or no matter what the Roswell incident was or whatever. But just throw a laughter curtain over it because it's just an uncomfortable subject, whether it be aliens or whatever you want to call it. But something that either they can't talk about or won't.
Well, I think you're right there. They can't. And they won't. And in lieu of either, let's do our best to do what we did so well in setting things in motion in 1947 so that more than any other subject in modern life, and correct me if you feel I'm off or exaggerating here, Greg, but I'm one of those people who has studied intently the history of media coverage of the UFO phenomena, mm-hmm. including – I'm probably the only person certainly that I know that's read every single one of the several hundred articles that the New York Times has ever published on the subject from the summer of 47 on.
Yeah.
And the media has gone to a tremendous amount of trouble to associate, and popular culture is kind of gone into lockstep with it over the decades, associate the idea of saying to someone, hey, Greg, I saw something in the sky the other day or the other night, and I couldn't identify it. And you see my lips moving, but there's a part of you that hear me say, hey, Greg, I'm a little delusional. I want to feel special. I want to be on the Oprah show. I want to write a best-selling book. I'm a trickster. I want to perpetrate hoaxes on people. I have shell shock or post-traumatic stress. That is essentially what has happened over the past 60-odd years with this subject in terms of wiring it up with a whole world of shiny objects and myths and disinformation instead of responding, yeah, what was that thing that you saw last week or 64 years ago in the sky that was going 4,000 miles an hour and then zigzagged and took off straight up, and we didn't have anything that did that back then, or maybe we don't have anything that does that quite like that now, or. And Rendlesham and Roswell embody two of the most significant, the most important, and potentially two events with implications that are so shattering to Western civilization, for, you know, lack of a more descriptive term, that the forces that be, the secret government, MJ-12, whatever names you want to give to it, that's one of their jobs constantly, is running damage control by doing as much damage they can or putting forward pseudoscience to explain it away, as was so popular in the 40s and 50s, everything and the 60s, everything from swamp gas to refractions off of clouds. In the case of Rendlesham Forest, men mistook a landed object on the ground or machines coming overhead and shining beams of light down to the ground or landing in the forest as the Orford Nets Lighthouse a dozen miles away. These things would be funny if they weren't so insulting.
Yeah, well, that was one of the questions. And I don't want to get too much into the, you know, what's wrong with these explanations, because you've gone into them on other shows. Other people have gone into them. People can look that up.
Well, I'm glad to, though. And again, the Orford Nest Lighthouse is a lighthouse. It has a rotating beacon. And at the correct time of year, that would be winter months when the leaves are essentially off the trees, although Rendlesham has a extremely large concentration of evergreen-type trees, so the foliage is year-round.
Yeah.
If you're standing in certain places and looking in a certain direction at just the right time. When that light rotates, you can catch that flash for, you know, a second or two. But again, I've been out in that field over the past 20-odd years, day, night, summer, fall, winter, spring, and have, at, you know, in the winter have seen it and have had to laugh because it is so having nothing to do with the descriptions of the eyewitnesses who have had the courage to come forward. And who have gained bloody little, if anything, by doing so. And, you know, like Larry, have suffered a great deal for having the courage to blow the whistle on whatever the hell happened there.
So the other witnesses that you mentioned that are Burroughs and Peniston, I got a couple questions from listeners, which we will get to.
Sure.
However, one of them is actually... you know, I think you already said what you think of the time traveler claims. You said, well, let's wait and see until they publish their information. The other question, this is from Andy Bannum, was why do you think he waited 30 years to announce that he received some sort of binary code from the craft?
Well, you know, I wish I knew. I was there when he actually made that public announcement, which was almost a year and a half ago. I can tell you exactly when it was. It was on the 28th of December. 2010, which was 30 years after the events in question. A number of us were back in Suffolk at a small conference. And let me tell you, that audience, that was a tough audience, and they were very angry. Jim, I have not listened yet, but he actually did an interview earlier this week with Angela, and she asked him a lot of tough questions about it, and apparently he contradicted himself in his answers. I'm going to have to listen to that so I can put my money where my mouth is.
Yeah, one of the listeners actually mentioned that.
Yeah, I'm confused, and I also have to say that for months prior to essentially going underground to write their book and stopping 90% of their online comments, maybe more than 90%, there was a tremendous amount of telling us that this was going to be paradigm shifting, how much they were looking forward to filling us all in on these particulars. In fact, they were going to be doing it at this conference on June 17th in Suffolk, England, and then backed out and decided not to do it, leaving us to reorganize the conference, and it's going to be a great conference in a very different way now. But I'm frankly very disappointed that they didn't make good on the claims that they were making and remaking and making for months leading up to deciding not to make this public when they said they were going to.
Right.
So I don't know how to answer that question, Greg. I wish I did.
Yeah, I mean, I read up on it a bit, and I guess there was some segment on it on a TV show, I guess a British TV show, where they found some computer programmer, and they'd had him look at the binary code that was in his notebook, in Peniston's notebook, and it came out that the future of the human race was centered on some geographical location that turned out to be some lost island off the coast of... It gets very, very involved, complicated, and seemingly far away from the incident itself.
Well, it does very much so. And the gentleman you're referring to, who is, I believe, doing his best to lay out what this purported message says to the world, is a writer and author named Gary Osborne. Gary is somebody who I have a lot of respect and admiration for. He's best known for his work kind of in the John Anthony West and Graham Hancock area of antiquarian studies, especially around ancient Egypt. And he has a new book out on that now. I think it's actually featured as the book of the month on Graham Hancock's website.
Oh, okay.
This is a very separate area of Gary's expertise. And he's the first one to say, I can tell you what the message that I've been handed says and, you know, draw certain inferences from that. But I have no way of telling you where the message comes from. if it's authentic, so to say, if it lines up with Penniston and Burroughs' beliefs about its source. And again, for that, I can only respect Gary. But, you know, they're alleging that they are going to be able to prove that it comes from time travelers from our future. Now, as somebody who is fairly plodding in their investigative methodology, and two of my true mentors when I was coming up as a completely unknown person in this field when I was considerably younger were a retired staff officer for the Hungarian army who during World War II was in charge of all photo reconnaissance and photo analysis. The other was a very tough, no-nonsense New York City police detective, Pete Mazzola, a guy who we lost much too young, who taught me to investigate UFO claims, incidents, events, much the way that law enforcement personnel look into felonious, you know, activities, and always to begin by investigating the most mundane, everyday, boring explanations. And when you keep doing that, it's more like Conan Doyle's Great Holmes character did in, you know, his investigations in that great series. But it's also been troubling to me that Jim and John have always and only maintained that this is it, it's unquestioned for them, and that they're going to prove it to all of us, rather than ask these questions in public that we're talking about right now. It's one thing to believe in what you feel is the truth. It's another thing to let your beliefs govern, you know,
your beliefs
all of the behavior around it.
Right. Yeah, it's that happens. I don't know. I mean, it seems like I encounter that so much just in people who say, I'm doing an investigation and research, and this is what it is. And I ask them a question, and they either ignore what I've said, talk around it, or say, well, I just don't realize exactly what they're saying. It's like, but you should be convincing people worse than me who think you're completely full of crap. I'm being actually nice to you. So,
well,
you're just going to convince fans. You're not going to convince the people that make a difference, which is people outside the UFO arena.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that I've always valued about our friendship and our colleagueship. Although I come from a point of view that we're dealing with a absolutely, truly anomalous phenomena, the most conservative explanation for which, as far as I'm concerned, after more than 30 years of serious research and investigation, is the extraterrestrial hypothesis, is that the best investigators maintain a very healthy skepticism. And to underscore that point, you know that for several decades, on and off, I worked as Bud Hopkins' assistant. And for the two people in your audience that are not familiar with Bud, who we lost last year at the age of 80 to cancer, Bud was really the true pioneer, visionary investigator of the most troubling area of UFO studies, the so-called abduction phenomena. And I never went into a single investigation, and I mean that in terms of working with him over the years on the so-called Linda case, the Brooklyn Bridge UFO abductions, and that was a six-year investigation resulting in a phenomenal book, Witnessed, the True Story of the Brooklyn Bridge UFO Abductions, or an investigation in the sense of sitting down with somebody that introduced themselves to me at a conference and chatting with them for 40 minutes about their alleged events, where I began by saying, oh my God, I believe you, tell me about your UFO abduction, as opposed to after several hundred investigations and seeing evidences that would stand up in a court of law, I hit a point years ago where I felt I had lost the luxury of disbelief. And I realized when that happened, I had to be very careful because I, in quote, now knew that there was something very real afoot. And that makes me feel that I have to be all the more responsible for approaching each new investigation or claim or even each new dialogue, in like the one we're having right now, of approaching it cautiously, respectfully, and skeptically, before establishing for myself that this is something that has some real gravitas and weight and aspects that, you know, make me feel it's worthy of more serious and in-depth investigation.
Right. It's one of those things where you know, Peter, I don't 100% agree with you on your research with Bud, but I am not I'm not an abduction researcher. I never claimed to be. I never wanted to be. So the question is up in the air for me. It's not you're full of crap and you're deluding yourselves and all this. It's more like the question is still open to me. And if I had been doing what you had been doing for the past over, you know, two decades, I might have a different idea about what was going on. Right or wrong, I would have been exposed to far more information, far more, you know, cases, known my investigative and trust my investigative methods. And so, you know, as long as somebody's reasonable, which you are, you know, Peter, you're far more reasonable than just about anybody I know in the UFO arena.
I'll try and work on that and become more unreasonable when I'm
okay.
Yeah.
See, if somebody is pushing something on me personally and saying this is it and won't hear, you know, anything, you know, won't answer the questions, I start to, you know, like any reasonable person, I start to doubt that they have the objectivity required to report these things to me. So, yeah. But then in the case of somebody who's, you know, done the work and is very intelligent, I can just say, look, unless I get abducted by something, I have to reserve judgment. Or if it happens in my family or whatever.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, who knows what I think of it.
That, in fact, you know, you said something that really this all comes back to for me, that you know, never chose to get involved in this area of research. I have to say, although, and some people may feel I'm playing games with language here, I didn't really choose to get involved in this as much as it became an obsession more than 30 years ago when my late sister Helen told me about her abduction-related experiences, which if she were or somebody were to tell me exactly what she told me then, now it would be like, oh, I've heard that literally hundreds of times, and that is aspects of an archetypical abduction experience. My sister wasn't a liar. She didn't make stuff up to, you know, get my attention, and it changed my life. I can't even say overnight. It changed my life in a matter of minutes, and I wanted to know what happened to her, and that is really the force that got me involved in looking into this. And when I say to you or to anybody that the evidences that I've seen could hold up in a court of law, you can see a wonderful microcosm of it all again in Witnessed, which I think is it's certainly the best book on a multiply witnessed abduction, as opposed to somebody just saying this happened to me. The physical aspects of it relative to the person's body, implants, tremendous amounts of detail, a lot of which we've gone to great pains to never make very public, that when seen all together is indicative of things like this. So at the same time, you know, I've heard Travis Walton speak about his experience, and there are a few people out there that are more articulate and thoughtful about their events. Also, Travis uses words with the economy of a Vermont farmer. He doesn't, you know, he's not a big talker. He's more like Gary Cooper and uses words with impact to describe what happened to him. But I've heard him say more than once, you know, and for anybody that is not familiar with who Travis is, his abduction experience became an international news event, because when he went missing for 4 or 5 days, as I recall, and the friends that he was with were being looked at for having murdered him and hidden his body when he turned up totally dehydrated and disoriented after he had gotten, you know, after he had been released and turned loose back on Earth here. And Travis is the first one to say, you know, when people express the thought that they think, you know, I'm lying or not worth believing because these things couldn't happen. Of course I understand. You know, I'd think I was crazy, too, if it hadn't happened to me. But the fact is it did.
Yeah. Some people may not know that I think you've got about 10 minutes left here, if that's true. Yes? I mean, well, on the show, not like in your life or anything.
Thank you. Thank you. I know I have till December 21st, like
yes,
the rest of us.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I've.
Well, let's go a little bit beyond it.
Okay, because I've got some stuff, questions from listeners that I said, yes, I will ask Peter those. I'm going to be selfish, though, up front here and ask the last question that I had on here. I mean, there were other ones, too, but we've answered them. And what I thought listening to you, remembering what I'd read of your book, reading what had come up recently and the, you know, the arguments on either side, what do you think about some sort of, and you mentioned this when we were, you know, about half an hour ago when we were talking about this, what do you think of the theory of the events of Rendlesham 1980 December being some mixture of some of the psychological warfare or security stuff and some unknown, I'm not going to say aliens or anything like that, but some unknown aspect, some unknown precipitating event.
Yeah, works for me. And let me...
And I think that's kind of what's in your book to some extent.
Well, we're open to it. We know that Larry and John and Jim, among other people who were direct eyewitnesses, were meddled with, were, you know, mentally, thoughts were put in their heads to make them feel that their actual memories were now questionable to some degree because somebody had gone out of their way to mix in completely staged memories. And I'll give you an idea of how dramatic this is. December 2010, when we were all in England, there was a point where John Burroughs was on stage taking questions from the audience. And overwhelmingly, this was a British audience. The majority of the audience was local. This was the background event that they grew up with. Some of them were older people who remembered the event. Other ones were younger, and this is the event that has overshadowed their whole lives. So they were incredibly well informed. It was also a highly emotional audience, and there were moments where the crowd got to be a bit unnerving. They were furious at points. Fights broke out in the audience. I don't mean punches were thrown, but full-scale arguments before people calmed down. They're still enraged about being lied to by Her Majesty's government, by the United States Air Force. And then when Jim Peniston dropped this bomb on them that, folks, I'm going to tell you it was, you know, time travelers from our future. But I can't go into detail now because we're working on a television special. And you know, and then on the special, this stuff wasn't aired. I mean, this is not good. It makes it look that there are ulterior motives and not, you know, very good ones. But John was taking questions and somebody said, John, is it true, as I've heard, that when you came upon the vehicle, the machine in the woods, the craft, that you pulled your service weapon on it and went into a two-handed stance? I don't have the tapes were made by the television documentary company, who I'm very disappointed to say is never did not allow us to film it to make money for the charity that we were there to raise money for, a group of children's hospices in Suffolk, which I'm still angry about. But you'll have to take my word that I'm doing my best to characterize what I'm about to say accurately. John's response to that was, I'm not sure. It may have happened. I don't know absolutely. John, is it true, as I've heard, that when you know, you put your, you reholstered your weapon and then you, jumped on the thing and it went, you know, 10 meters with you on it before you let go. John, I don't know. I'm not sure. It may have happened. I'm not sure if it's a real memory or an implanted memory. John, were you abducted? I don't know. It may have happened. I'm not sure. That was unnerving. And your heart has to go out to the guy on a certain level because he is tortured. There was a time when he and Jim were working with Linda Howe, who did a lot of investigation and research into this, and for a time actually did a series of lectures where John and then John and Jim were included. And during those presentations, they allowed footage to be shown from regressive hypnosis sessions that they had had with hypnotherapists. And I thought that was very courageous of them because they're both terrified. And to the best of my knowledge, have never absolutely been able to lift that curtain allegorically and allow themselves to experience or see or understand exactly what they are so frightened of.
There's a couple of, I've got a question actually while we were sitting here too, so let me try and get to all of them.
Yeah, let's get to as many as we can.
Yeah, this one is from Steve, and I guess it goes sort of with the psychological warfare or security explanation. If someone believes they may have been a target or victim of an energy weapon similar, I don't know if you can answer this, but similar in psychological effect to what may have been used in Bentwaters, what type of anomalies might show up in either blood work or other work, other tests like an MRI or PET scan?
Oh, maybe that's easy. Even I can answer that one.
Many years after
know.
The event. You don't know. Okay.
I'm good at that answer.
Yes, I wouldn't know either. There, that might be something you might be able to look up, and I don't know how much you can trust anything you find on on the internet, but that might be a question for a different guest.
It's a very good question. I have no idea how to answer it accurately.
I think he's just saying, you know, if these people claim this stuff, could we possibly do blood work or whatever and see if they've if that would hold up because, you know, it would show up later.
Let me just parenthetically insert here that Jim and possibly John made some mention of sodium amethyl, which is a very nasty drug, not to be confused with pentothal,
right,
which is used to elicit, you know, your truest memories, where amethyl is used to help screw you up and convince you. I would imagine that if blood work were done soon afterwards,
right,
that one could establish something, but, you know, 31 and a half years later, I'm guessing not so much.
Right. There is a man who wrote me from Yorkshire, UK this morning. Russell McNair. Do you know him?
No, but I know Yorkshire.
Yes. McNair asks, I believe in the second night of the incident, an officer by the name of Bonnie Tampling was in charge of a detachment investigating the incident. I have heard reports that she suffered some sort of a mental breakdown on the spot. What efforts have been made to trace this witness or indeed her military records?
That is a great question. And to the best of my knowledge, she did suffer, I guess what I would call a breakdown based on, I'm trying to recall the specifics here, but she was in the cab of a military vehicle on location and a light anomaly flew right into her vehicle and was right there in the cab with her. And the effect on her was very profound and not in a positive way. I don't know. Her name has come up a number of times on a Facebook page that I'm a member of where there is, I think, really the best and most informed and completely open dialogue and series of exchanges about this, which I would invite any of your listeners to visit or join. I think it's called the Rendlesham Lone Ranger UFO Sightings. Lighthearted name, but a serious page.
Yeah.
And I know there's been some chat about Bonnie. and efforts to learn more about what happened to her. But there's no question that that woman really suffered as a result of what she was exposed to there.
Right. So you don't know really of any efforts besides what you've mentioned to
not offhand
question
no.
her.
What I would say is
establish that she actually exists, etc.
If one goes to that page, it's a simple matter to become a member. And I should say here that the reason it has that name is there is kind of a secondary factor at work here, which is that after our book was published, our publisher received quite a number of letters from men who were involved, mostly men, some women, a number of whom we name in the book. And those letters, of course, were forwarded to my co-author and I, and some of them were very moving and backed up the allegations we put forward in the book. However, there was a secondary amount of communications with the publisher and with us, and then emails to us from individuals who were in the Air Force who had been stationed on Bentwaters or RAF Woodbridge to say, read with interest the account in Left at East Gate. Mm-hmm. I was not stationed there at the time. I was stationed there 6 months earlier or 2 years later. Let me tell you about my UFO incident. It is an area with a fairly high level of incidents. And a woman who was also a security cop like Larry, and one of the first females to do it, and somebody who suffered because she was a female and had to deal with the old boys network there and, military culture, very macho, she is the one who set up that page because she really felt like an outsider. But my point is this. If you go on that page – and again, become a member and post that question, the chances are pretty good that somebody can tell you what are the updates on Bonnie or who might be investigating that.
Right. And then you can go check it out yourself if you feel so inclined.
Their work, you bet. Exactly.
Yeah. A question came in from one of the other DJs here, my friend Bennett. He says, what evidence we were talking about your work with Bud Hopkins and your statement that evidence that would hold up in a court of law. He wants to know what you mean by that, the evidence that would hold up in a court of law for the abduction scenario.
Well, thank you, Bennett, for calling me on that. I can't imagine a more important question. Number one, quite a number of individuals who allege that they've had these experiences find out either because you can feel it subcutaneously under the skin, or it may show up in an X-ray or a CAT scan, that there is a small object in their body. It may be way, way, way up in their nasal cavity. It may be behind their knee, or in some cases, literally in their head, or in their arm, that we've come to call implants. They have no moving parts. They're silicone-based or they're metallic-based. Some of them are round. Some of them are more the shape of a grain of rice. They're completely unnatural. They have no business being there. The memory is of when it happened is associated with a visitation or an abduction experience. They've been studied. Dr. Roger Lear has written several books about implants, and he is out. He's actually very close to you in Los Angeles area, and Dr. Roger has done more work than anyone around these implants, establishing their reality and removing them for study. Now, another thing is scars that appear in the course of an event. It can be a long, thin scar, or more commonly, something that looks like a very tiny ice cream scoop of tissue that's been taken out. It's always immediately cauterized. There's no blood. There's no fabric torn as a result of it. And again, always associated with the event itself. In families, and part of the privilege of working with Bud was not only meeting so many good people, and I should say here, these are people, Bennett, that are really no different than you and I, except that they've had these experiences, and they come from every socioeconomic, racial kind of background imaginable. The late John Mack, Dr. Mack of Harvard, a distinguished professor of psychiatry there, a very successful private psychiatrist, a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, who was tragically killed by a drunken driver in England in 2004. I was fairly close by when it happened and investigated it to the best that I could, and I do feel it was a true accident and an infuriating one. But one thing Dr. Mack did that few other people investigating this phenomena should have done, because they were not real mental health professionals, is that Mack administered standard batteries of psychological tests to the abductees that he worked with. And in every case, you got the same sampling that you would expect in a representative part of the public at large, except for this particular anomalous series of actions or events. Other things, in a court of law, eyewitness testimony is considered somewhat controversial, but it's still used to convict people and put them to death. Other family members, a spouse, a sibling, may have a memory of your event, so to say. There are certain scenarios that play themselves throughout these things. When, do you remember when little Jimmy went missing at the 4th of July picnic and we got so upset that we called the police and everybody searched for 2 hours and then they found him on his tricycle under an apple tree 4 miles away with this mark on his knee and no memory of how he got there? And on and on and on and on. People are returned to their bedrooms, and there are a number of really well-documented cases where they're wearing something that they weren't wearing when they went to bed. Somebody put them in the wrong clothing. Again, this is real research of really genuine situations. There's nothing specious or half-assed about it. And, you know, some may be hearing me just say this and say, well, you know, he can say anything he wants on the radio. I would encourage anyone who really would like to look into this more to read any of Bud's fine books, any of Dr. Mack's books, David Jacobs' books. There is now a fairly good amount of true data on this. Another extraordinary book, and I would recommend it particularly to medical, mental health professionals, academics, is a book called UFOs and Abductions, published by the Kansas University Press. I think with one exception, everyone in that book is a PhD who's contributed important essays to this very important book.
I've never even heard of that study.
In its infancy, but it's important area of study, and it's a very real phenomenon, like it or not.
I've never even heard of that book, Peter. Bennett says thank you. I appreciate the answer. I have heard all those everything you've said. I have heard from you and other people I respect. The thing it always comes down to for me is, well, if you took this into a court of law, would a jury say, well, then there is something anomalous going on? Possibly. But the point is that when you take something into a court of law, it's usually something that people acknowledge happens between humans and in our daily lives, unfortunately, you know, murders and rapes and whatever, you know, robberies. But well, this isn't something that normally most people have any experience with or even accept as something real. So I think it'd be kind of difficult because you're comparing it to something that is outside of people's experience and to most people has not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the problem I see with the court of law.
Well, it is a problem, of course, and a huge problem. But again,
it doesn't happen. It's just kind of, you know. It's going in a direction that people do not expect if there is an actual, you know, court case brought for this. I would love to see one. I'd like to see a mock trial done. I think it'd be great.
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, again, like I said, we kind of open and close left at Eastgate with the understanding that we are going to present a variety of evidences, exhibits, proofs or alleged proofs of our initial allegations that something truly anomalous happened to my co-author, to men he was with, to men on the two preceding nights, women as well, mm-hmm. and that there is actual varieties of evidence to back it up. One other point as far as abduction goes before moving on, in the so-called Linda case, the Brooklyn Bridge case, we have a situation which is unlike anything that has ever been so fully documented and studied in literature. And this is one that I'm most familiar with because I was there the day that she showed up in 1989 and worked regularly with Bud straight through the next six odd years as we developed the evidence. This is a woman who had a history of these events going back to early childhood, who was observed to have been floated through a plate glass window of her bedroom of a 12th-story apartment near the Brooklyn Bridge on Manhattan Island at about 2 in the morning, that was observed by several dozen people who came forward to report it and who in many cases were so shocked, were so amazed by what they had seen, that once word got out that this author investigator was researching this incident, we received drawings, firsthand accounts, met with many of these people, and that doesn't include the people who came forward and said, I saw it too, and let me put it to you by telling you this, that, and the other thing, but I don't want my account used in your book. For anyone, again, who wants to challenge themselves to see if they can come to a point where they might say, good Lord, this may well be something more than patent nonsense, and I cannot believe how upset I am by the preponderance of actual evidence that I'm seeing here. I would suggest if you really want to take this challenge, read Witnessed, read UFOs and Abductions, edited by Dr. David Jacobs, published by the University of Kansas Press in 2000. Read Dr. John Mack's book, Abduction, Bud's book, Intruders. There is a growing amount of very serious literature on this, and I apologize that it's such a difficult subject, but we're stuck with it. And if one really studies it, you have very little recourse but to begin to take it extremely seriously.
Mm-hmm. One more question from one of the listeners, if it's all right.
Sure.
And I believe we discussed this on one of our interviews, but I don't know if it's posted or, you know, if the guy actually listened to all the interviews or not. James wanted to know more about the Wilhelm Reich connection to Rendlesham and your experience with Reich and Reichian therapy. I think we have gone into this on past shows. But the first time I heard about this, you were lecturing about it, and I was kind of flabbergasted. What the hell is this thing doing on the base?
Yeah.
Have you been able to establish that that's what it was?
Yeah, I'm not trying to dodge this question. It's just such a serious question and deserves a really serious answer, that there's no way I can do much more than pay it lip service here and, you know, send you some of my studies, research papers on it, which I would invite you to post online. I'll waive any copyright. They can go viral. But not just years, but decades of research have gone into this aspect. The last thing that we needed was any additional controversy. Writing a book like this, and Larry was not thrilled about this. Every colleague that I spoke to about it, with one exception, felt even if my deductions were accurate, that I was not doing the greater subject of UFO studies or the specific Rendlesham case study any favors by including this. But in the early 1950s, Dr. Reich, whose work and discoveries, you know, are certainly worthy of a year of shows, developed a very simple apparatus to affect the climate, to draw moist air into an area that had settled into a drought-like condition, called a cloudbuster. These machines work. I saw one actually operating some years ago, and I will never forget it. Wright kept extremely scrupulous records of this device's ability to produce this result. And he, when he began to work with this device, doing field work in Maine and then outside of Phoenix, Arizona, wanting to choose an area where if he could produce rain, the results would be that much more worthy of study because of the low rainfall that it appeared that, that the area had received. And we're talking about 1953, 1955 here, that the operation of the device, both in Maine and in Arizona, attracted UFO activity. I know how that sounds, but that was the fact. And it was multiply witnessed by people in Phoenix area, by people in southern Maine, by colleagues of Reich's, including my former therapist, Dr. Ellsworth F. Baker, who was Reich's first assistant for the last 11 years of his life. Mm-hmm. And shortly before Larry and I went on the first of, God, I think I'm going back to England next month for about the 25th time. on the first of our trips over there in February of 88, he was going through, it was actually fundraising literature for a college then being created in just outside of Princeton, New Jersey, for the study of Reich's work and the propagation of his discoveries. That I was involved as a fundraiser in, and he saw a picture of a cloudbuster in it. And he asked me if this was one of those things that I had referred to in passing sometime before, and I said yes.
Yeah.
And he said, we had one of these on base, except that it was huge, and it was painted olive drab and flat-mounted on a trailer and off by the flight line, and I kind of freaked. I thought he was yanking my chain or kidding me or, you know, I didn't know what to think. But I said, well, I don't believe you in so many words. It would need a well or, you know, a lake or running water nearby to operate. And he said we had wells all over the base, which they did. And I can only add at this point without spending every bit of the rest of our time,
yeah.
And I'll be happy to come back and do like a whole separate show on this sometime,
yeah.
That I did come to feel that, in fact, the Air Force did have one of these machines. Reich had sent them schematics in the 50s. I mean, they had it, the information on it, and that they were fascinated by it and unfortunately seemed to have built a very large one and either used it irresponsibly or did a weather weapons test with it in October of 1986. Larry and I arrived there less than 5 months later and saw the damage of the quote-unquote freak storm, unlike anything that had ever swept through Suffolk before, that brought down, by the Forestry Commission's estimate, 1.3 million mature evergreen trees in the course of several hours in something that they called a hurricane. Now, I grew up in a hurricane zone, and hurricanes by nature and by definition, more important, are moisture driven. Not a drop of rain fell. And I mean, shingles, slate shingles were blown off of roofs and, you know, went through windows and embedded themselves in walls. It's amazing that there wasn't more death. There was plenty of destruction. And when I made this information public, Dr. James DeMeo, who works at a research laboratory outside of Ashland, Oregon,
right.
And who has continued this work in a remarkably effective way all over the world, then informed me rather discreetly and gave me permission to publish around it that he was aware of a very similar, quote-unquote, freak, incredibly destructive storm that swept in without any warning whatsoever, and I should stress that as well, in close proximity to an American air base in West Germany a few years before that. Anyway, that's the shortest answer I can give without sounding like a total and complete lunatic. I write it up at some length and left at Eastgate, and I stand by that allegation.
All right. Well, if you want to send me those papers.
Completely separate.
What? I'm sorry.
No, it's just completely separate from the events of December 1980.
Right,
but,
right.
That's one of the things we stumbled on that I felt at a certain point compelled to address.
Well, I would have too. And have you ever found out, you know, not to belabor it too much, have you ever found out if they were anything, looked like anything else that was in the, you know, arsenal of the United States Air Force or the United States Armed Forces?
Absolutely nothing. And even after I came to believe that this was a fact, I decided, and Larry's more than happy to agree with me, that I was not going to push to publish this unless we found another witness who had also observed an identical device in that location or another location that made sense. And in fact, we found two sergeants who also were stationed at Bentwaters Woodbridge who absolutely remembered the same machine and identified it as such when they saw the picture.
Yeah, did you not have a picture of one of those sitting on the flight line, or was that just something that looked a picture you had of one of the Cloudbuster devices from somewhere else?
Oh yeah, from somewhere else.
Okay.
Certainly didn't have a picture of it on location in Rendlesham Forest or at RAF Bentwaters
okay.
or Woodbridge. No.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything else that looks like a bunch of tubes with a bunch of electrical conduits sticking out of them going down into the ground. It just, yeah.
It's really simple, and it is difficult to confuse with any other piece of apparatus I've ever seen or been exposed to.
Right. I think that's all the questions from all the listeners and me. And of
wow.
course, yeah, we could talk forever because we do.
We could.
do you want to re-announce and re-plug the Rendlesham conference and tell people where they can get information? And I, of course,
yes.
will post it on the site. When is the conference? And is it next month?
It is. It's going to be on Sunday, the 17th of June, and it's going to be held in Suffolk, East Anglia, which is about an hour and a half, 2 hours from London. It is something I'm looking forward to more than I can say, and the particulars are as follows. It's open to the public. It's going to run from 10 in the morning till about 11:30 at night. The featured speakers include a man who is extremely important and highly respected in the UK, not as well known here. Alan Godfrey is a retired police constable who was serving with the West Yorkshire Metropolitan Police Force at the time of the Rendlesham Forest incidents. And a month before that, got caught up in a tremendously important UFO event as a police constable. Had the courage to go forward about what he had seen and experienced, and caught holy hell, was a subject of ridicule. He rarely speaks in public, and Alan has told us this is going to be the last time that he is going to be speaking in public about it. He's kind of had it, and he's getting on in years, and we are very honored to have him. For anybody, and I know that, you know, a lot of your listeners, certainly in the States, are not going to be able to get over for this, but for anyone that can, it's also going to be a rare opportunity to hear Timothy Good speak. And Tim is arguably the most respected, most knowledgeable UFO investigator in Great Britain, maybe in the history of Great Britain, who is better connected than anybody that I know in the field, bar none. Following Tim, we're going to have Captain Robert Salas. Bob is a former United States Air Force captain. And in 1967, he was involved in another of the best documented, most remarkable, jaw-dropping nuclear UFO-related incidents in history, and that's the Malmstrom Air Force Base UFO event. At the time...
Yeah, I know Bob, actually. I've visited him at home a couple times.
He's also somebody of I have tremendous personal admiration and respect for. He co-wrote a book on this event called Faded Giant, and I think for a former United States Air Force officer to pen a book like that and talk about the nuclear presence takes a lot of guts as well as character to do it. He has been attacked for doing it, you know, because how dare he give these secrets out and, you know, bring anything less than honor to the United States Air Force, which certainly deserves a lot of honor. But he was actually working at the base and observed as 20 nuclear missiles shut down as the UFO encounter occurred overhead. My dear friend and colleague and co-author, Larry Warren, a former United States Air Force security police officer, is going to be emceeing the conference. And boy, talk about having a style all his own. That is going to lend quite a note to it. He'll also be up with me for the time or part of the time that I'll be giving my talk to give any comments that he wants. Gary Hazeltine, another, in this case, serving currently British police detective, is going to be speaking about the organization and database, or the database of police-related UFO activity that he has created and that he runs, as well as his work in researching the Rendlesham Forest incident. And I'll be speaking in part about updates on the case and doing a certain amount to kind of rehabilitate it and bring us back to the actual evidences that are on question that do establish it in no uncertain terms as a truly anomalous, genuine UFO incident. We're going to have a friend and colleague of mine who I'm really proud to have along, Jennifer Stein, who is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, among other things, has traveled extensively in the Middle East with Zachariah Sitchin, mm-hmm. And is one of the best informed and most grounded American crop circle researchers. And she's going to be doing a presentation. And this is going to be doubly challenging, I think, for a British audience. And they kind of consider crop circles their own, and well, they should. But I've seen her presentation, and it's absolutely brilliant. So she'll be speaking on crop circles. And then, as mentioned, Sasha Christie, who works with several organizations relative to witnesses and contactee and abductees, will be talking about her experiences that run for a lifetime. And we'll have one or two other surprise speakers. Tickets are only £20 for the entire day. I think that's about $30 right now, give or take. Yeah. And for anybody that is interested, or even if you know you can't go but you have a friend in the UK or in Europe that you think might, please let them know and help us promote this event. I'm pretty sure it's going to be completely sold out, but because we've had to reorganize it after Jim and John and Charles Halt, who was invited, accepted, and then withdrew without any explanation, that we've had to reorganize it on short notice. I don't want there to be an empty seat in the house. And the URL is very easy to remember. It's RendlesshamUFO.com.
All right, Peter. Thanks so much.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you, brother.
And I always want to talk to you longer about one. Actually, somebody asked, wrote in while you were describing the conference and asked what you knew about Ted Owens.
Not much.
Okay.
So probably better not even to comment.
Ted Owens, the PK man. I think I've heard of this guy. Isn't he the guy that does psychometry photographs and things like that?
I think so. Yeah. And I'm one of those people who actually feels if I don't know enough about a subject or an individual to hold an intelligent opinion,
yeah.
I'm going to choose not to have an opinion.
Right, exactly. I don't know.
No more.
That's the most horrible. Two of the most horrible things that people seem to not want to say is, I was wrong and I don't know.
I'm good at I don't know. I'm pretty good at I was wrong. But I sort of think a lot of our wonderful brothers and sisters here in America feel I might not have much money or power, but damn it, I'm entitled to my opinion on anything. And if I don't know about the subject, that's not going to stop me from saying my mind on it.
Right, exactly.
That's their opinion, and they're entitled to it.
Doesn't mean anybody has to listen.
I'll really look forward to coming back later in the season, giving you guys a blow-by-blow on these events.
Yeah.
And I will be doing, actually, my first sort of follow-ups on what does go down in England next month in July. I'll be speaking in Phoenix and in Sedona in sort of the middle, a little after the middle of July in Arizona. And for information there, go to Phoenix MUFON's website. And,
oh, okay.
If it's not posted yet, it will be. Hoping to see some of my friends from the area there when I go back.
I'll try to get out there.
38 degrees that yeah. I understand I'll be walking into.
Yeah, so you get to come in there at the absolute ridiculously hottest time of the year. So that's great.
Hey, man, I'll tell you what. that's one of the perks on the job. Yes, sir.
Well, Peter, thanks so much for being on the show, and you'll look forward to having you on again after the conference. And we never had your friend on who was going to tell me about his incredible sighting at a –
Yes, my friend Pat, who works in law enforcement in New Mexico.
Yes, I didn't know how much you wanted to spit out of that. Yes, law enforcement in New Mexico.
He has actually I won't say the name of the huge competitive radio show that he was a guest on some months back, but, you know, given the attention span of many listeners or the fact they might not have been listening to that particular show that night, I mentioned it to him. He's okay about it. Wow. Did you ever try to contact him?
No, I don't think I did. I think you did send me his contact information, and it was while I was not working and trying to figure out if I was still going to do this show and a whole bunch of other junk.
Well, we'll follow up on that together.
I would love to follow up on it.
Plus,
people will want to listen because I ask far better questions.
Well, let me tell you, that's one without, you know, digressing too much. He had an experience, a sighting, whatever you want to call it, that I will never forget. And I've been back to that remote location in New Mexico now twice.
Uh-huh.
And gee whiz. As you can imagine, a lot of people have shared a lot of accounts with me over the decades. This is one for the books, though, and this is a guy who is, without guile, honest, again, a very courageous law enforcement officer. And don't you just love this? Several months before the Rendlesham event, he was rotated off of RAF Bentwaters to another base, but he was there, knew some of the players, and you can't make this stuff up, folks. Well, you can actually, but why bother?
Of course you can make it up, but it's, you know, it's the synchronicities are fun, so.
Anyway, Greg, I'll see you around the campus, brother, and
all right.
Thank you for having me back. Send the big check to me at the usual address.
I will. You're going to have to send me your PayPal because that's how I do it now.
Oh, well, all right. No more gold doubloons. Okay.
No, those cost more to send than they're worth. So I'm just going to send you the PayPal. So
works for me.
Okay.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks so much, Peter. I'll talk to you soon.
You bet.
All right. Well, it's Peter Robbins, and I bet he can still hear me. Did he hang up? Yeah, I think he hung up. There he goes. Talking about the Rendlesham case and the recent, I don't know about allegations, but controversy from researcher Sasha Christie. I was going to bring all that up, but of course Peter knows all about it, and he mentioned it before I had a chance to background everybody on it. But you don't need any background. The listeners to this show are very intelligent. They know what's going on. And if they don't, they look it up because you realize you can do that. I don't know. Am I going to be here next week? I think I am. I'm going to San Diego for Mother's Day to see my mom. So I'm going to try and get back up here for a show. Nobody planned yet. Maybe Peter's friend there with the spectacular sighting, which, you know, normally I keep in an interview recently. I said, if I hear another sighting story, UFO sighting story I'm going to throw up. However, I reserve judgment when something is out of the ordinary and is just a good story. I mean, you don't have to believe these stories or not. They are good story. You know, they're compelling. Some of them, like I mentioned, Albert Rosales's site, the humanoid sighting reports. I don't know if I believe them. I don't know how accurate they are. I do know that they are compelling and fascinating stories that make me feel like I did when I used to read UFO books when I was a kid. Peter and I talked about that actually on one of the shows here. He's been on twice before, and you can listen to those shows. Just type in his name on Radio Mysterioso, and it'll come up. Yeah, like I said, if it's a good story, I would like to hear it. Some people listening are going to completely believe it. Other people are going to say, why do you believe something like that? I don't really believe or disbelieve it. I'm interested to hear the story. I'm interested to hear how the person expresses what they say they saw. Most people that tell me about sightings and things like that, they want to get it off their chest. They're not really complete in their information. They don't really actually know what to think, and they don't particularly care if they have an answer. They just wanted to, they just want to get the story out so that it's off their chest and somebody's looking at them funny or laughing at them. And I wouldn't, not usually anyway. Peter, there was a problem. I said that the show ran Eastern Standard Time from 10 to midnight and Pacific Standard Time from 8 to 10. Do you see a problem with the I did this on Facebook. Do you see a problem with the math there? I got my times right, but not the Eastern Standard Time, even though if you looked at it, you just wonder, well, does he start at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock Pacific Time? Anyway, so if people had been waiting for an hour at the beginning of the program, before the beginning of the program for it to start, I apologize now. This show will be posted within the next couple of days at RadioMysterioso.com. You can listen to it then, as most people do. And, do you know what? I was thinking of posting some pieces, some tracks from this CD called The Ghost Orchid, An Introduction to EVP. It was produced sometime in the 1980s or 90s, I believe. There's all these tracks of electro voice phenomena recorded off shortwave radios and a few other places. So let's hear a couple of those while we play ourselves out. And once again, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you real soon on Radio Mysterioso.
This is Raymond Cass.
Oh, this is the guy that the EVP researcher from the 1970s, who after Konstantin Radiev, or Radive, worked with picking up supposed anomalous voices on shortwave aircraft and other broadcasts. And this actually, I'll play this. It's like two minutes, 45 seconds of him talking about how he started, what he was doing, and what his methodology was. I think it's fascinating. Whether you believe, quote unquote, what he's saying or not, it's a fascinating area of research. And he's one of the pioneers. So I'm real happy to have this. And I think I will post it sometime in the next few weeks.
This is Raymond Cass. I've called this section of the tape Alien Voices because the utterances have a harsh, robotic, and rather stern character.
That is not his introduction. I think this is.
...of unknown origin...
Here we go.
...appearing on radio frequencies were first noticed in Scandinavia by the military in the 30s and were put down at the time to secret Nazi transmitters. But the voices spoke in unknown and mixed tongues, and after the war, no records of secret Nazi transmissions ever came to light. The voices didn't stop after the war, but their rapidity and that their transient nature precluded study. That is, until the tape recorder came into common usage in the 50s. A group of radio hams in Chicago studied the strange transmissions, male and female voices speaking in polyglot mode and lyrical tones. But it was not until 1959 that a Russian-born Swedish citizen, radio and TV producer, and filmmaker, Friedrich Jurgensen, noticed intrusions on tape and commenced his own systematic study. A disturbing fact soon emerged. The voices zeroed in onto the Swede, addressing him by name, revealing a knowledge of his thoughts and actions, and claiming to be the voices of deceased friends and acquaintances. The news spread rapidly, and soon experimenters and scientists all over the world were attempting to duplicate Jurgensen's work. Prominent among them was the Latvian psychologist Konstantin Raudiva. The effect on parapsychologists was traumatic. Accustomed to investigating the blind forces of the poltergeist and endless and somewhat boring card and dice-guessing experiments, they were confronted at once with living voices, which answered back. Speech being a mark of intelligence and a highly structured artifact. Taken by surprise, the British parapsychologists, without conducting experiments, rejected the objectivity of the voices, explaining them as breakthrough from taxis, police messages, or simply mechanical noises in the tape recorder. But their European counterparts were more cautious, and possibly with greater technical resources, they soon found out that they were indeed confronted with voices of unknown origin on tape, voices which were human-like, but exhibiting odd characteristics, like constructing a sentence from the elements of one or more languages, impinging on a regular broadcast, and by a strange process of metamorphosis, twisting the words of the speaker to suit their purposes and messages. The utterances were strangely lyrical and musical, but compressed and truncated. Rigorous economy with words, and the free use of coined words was common, the so-called neologisms. But like all paranormal phenomena, the voices came and went unpredictably. If the investigator probed too closely as to their source, it seemed as though they broke contact and left him stranded. This is known as the decline effect in psychical research. It is as though there are barriers and constraints against full contact and confrontation. It may be argued that a study of the voices on tape of non-human origin contributes nothing to our survival biologically, and that our sensory apparatus needs to be closely focused on material affairs to ensure our economic and planetary survival. The voices may be a mutant development of some remote corner of the subconscious mind, or a transient byproduct of the electromagnetic pollution which now rings our planet and presses outward into space. Or then again, the voices may herald the first tentative contact with intelligences from a parallel world, who, occasionally, when conditions are right, and at the interface between two separate realities, reach out to us, manipulating electronic apparatus and energies in ways at present unknown to us, studying our languages, probing our minds, presenting us, in many cases, with what we want to hear, or what they imagine we expect to hear. Between 1973 and 1977, I was situated in a so-called window area, an area in a city with a high electromagnetic flux. Nearby, a mass X-ray center, a radio hotspot, and utilizing an ordinary receiver tuned to the aircraft band, I was able to record, when atmospheric conditions were favorable, male and female voices of unknown origin, which occasionally addressed me by name. It has also been suggested that the radio receiver in use suffered from RF breakthrough, allowing foreign material to bypass the tuned circuits. All in all, a highly complex combination of factors, which unfortunately changed, but then allowed brief contact with another reality. That contact has now ceased. But then my attention is directed once more to mundane activities. My profession, politics and science, hi-fi and wine, women and song. No wonder a silvery female voice breaking through onto the airband sang in German, "We're from another world, but you've cut us out." Maybe one day the contact will be renewed. But let there be no mistake. The validity and objectivity of the paranormal voices doesn't depend on Jurgensen, Konstantin Raudiva, or myself, for there are now hundreds of voice experimenters worldwide, and the mysterious voices have been recorded from Siberia to Scunthorpe, and are stored in digital form in databanks in the West and in the Soviet Union. As I prepare this tape, some of my own examples are being processed at a U.S. Air Force base in Texas and have been fed into a computer of the Western Alliance in the Ruhr. We stand at the threshold of new discoveries, and a breakthrough may occur at any time. Some say we are not yet ready for the contact. Worldwide presentation of Jurgensen's results on two LP records has been cancelled. No reasons given. So do we keep our senses focused on terrestrial affairs, the energy crisis, economic growth, commerce and finance, war and armaments? Or is that pathway leading to ultimate disaster? Or will the silvery voices open our awareness to other realities and a wider universe?